This is Renegade Broadcasting. Welcome to the Solar Storm. This is your host, Kyle Hunt. Thank you so much for joining me here this Sunday night, October 12th, 2014, for a special show. Tonight I have a returning guest, Mr. Thomas Goodrich. He is the author of Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 to 1947. And he is a returning guest, but this time I've actually been able to read the entire work, and I've been working with Tom on putting together a documentary film for this book. So I have, a deeper insight into this material. Tom is also the author of a number of different books. On the last show, we discussed scalp dance and dispelled some of the myths about the peaceful, just fun-loving, spiritual Indians in America and how the Hollywood narrative is just a bunch of bogus. So please do search out the last show I did with Tom Goodrich. It was a very good show, and I'm excited to have him back. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kyle. Thanks again for having me.
Oh, you're quite welcome, and thanks for being here. And I also want to thank everybody out there who has donated to this project. It's really helping me to spend a lot of time to put together the most powerful material that I possibly can, using Tom's work here as an inspiration. So thank you to everyone who has donated to make this film possible. It is a lot of work putting together this type of film. We're going to do this very well, and Tom is doing a great job helping me get everything together and help communicate. I'm trying to get his message across in as clear as a fashion as possible without losing anything. And it's just, it's pretty overwhelming dealing with some of this material, especially when you're looking at it as well. But it needs to be done. Tom, I know a lot of people have mentioned to you that they want to see a documentary about this. And there really is nothing else out there in book form or in documentary form that encapsulates all of the pain and suffering that the German people endured during this time period, is there?
No, there isn't, Kyle. As a matter of fact, my book is the first book in 70 years that has made the attempt to try to incorporate all the various aspects of what I call the greatest crime in world history, World War II, into one volume. You think I've done it? I think I've done it. Many readers think I've done it. Good. Now, it's up to you, Kyle Hunt. You know, very few people in this world today can read. Let's face it. That's a fact. Very few people do read, spend the time to read. But virtually every human being out there with eyes and ears can watch a film. And that's why this is so important, because this is the film version of Hellstorm. And I want to also share with your listeners right now some of those who may have already contributed to this fund to help create this movie. Your money is very well spent, my friends. Kyle Hunt, I only knew Kyle through his program and a few exchanges of emails. In the last 2 weeks, I've gotten to know this gentleman very well, I think. He's a whirling dervish, quite honestly. Kyle wakes up probably at 6, and he hits it right then and doesn't put it down until way late at night. I know. I can tell. I monitor him at times. Kyle is a 24/7 individual on this. Your money is being very well placed, very well spent. You're going to see results of this. And I'm also extremely impressed by Kyle's artistic nature. I didn't have any idea or inclination about this. Kyle says I'm helping him. Well, at this point, that's all I am right now, is an assistant, a technical assistant, if you will. Kyle has more than enough expertise, more than enough art to create this on his own, but bless his heart, he is a gentleman. He's asking me to be a part of it, and I consider that a great honor, quite honestly. So I do think in a very short amount of time, as a matter of fact, that we're going to have a very nice film. Finally, a fitting monument to the people I call the voiceless victims of the world's worst war.
Well, Tom, I really appreciate all of those kind words, and I hope I can live up to expectations. Right now, from what we have already put together, I'm very confident that this is going to be a groundbreaking documentary. What you've put together in Hellstorm has just enabled me to be able just to pick out all of these different really powerful parts. And when people finally see this, when they see what actually happened to these so-called evil Nazis who just are the most terrible people in the world, I think things will really start to change. When people finally start having compassion for the people who lost World War II, then things really start to turn around in their minds concerning this narrative of the good war. And it was not a good war. It was just terrible. On all sides, the loss of life, the suffering was just incredible. But what the Germans endured was like nothing this world has ever seen before. It was not like the aftermath of World War I for the Germans, which was bad enough. This was something at just a whole nother scale. And the only thing that comes close to the suffering that they endured is actually the Holocaust narrative, the Shoah, which is quite interesting because that can't really be too well proven. And if you look at the Red Cross statistics, it seems that actually less Jews died during the whole course of World War II than just the citizens of Dresden in a couple of nights of repeated firebombing. And that, friends, was a real Holocaust, a burnt offering to some demonic type of God that is just bloodthirsty. That was so unimaginable to me, what it would have been like to put myself in those people's shoes. But Tom, that's what you do with your book, is you allow the reader, and now we're going to allow the viewer, to actually see what it was like going through this, surviving this Holocaust when so many of their loved ones did not.
Let's also include, Kyle, every German city during World War II suffered a similar fate as Dresden. We tend to point to Dresden as the most egregious and criminal bombing raid of the war, and it was. I think more people died there than any other German city. But that doesn't take away from Darmstadt and Würzburg and Düsseldorf and other cities throughout Germany that suffered the very same fate. I believe there was one in the book. I think it's either Düsseldorf or Dortmund, perhaps Dortmund, a much, much smaller place than Dresden. And yet in half an hour, 30,000 people died.
Mm-hmm.
30,000 people in a city probably less than 100,000, a third of the population were incinerated in a firestorm. So even though Dresden is the most egregious symbol of the air crimes, the air massacre, virtually every German city suffered a similar fate. But yes, once I think you'll agree with me, Kyle, now you know very well the experience of a researcher, a historian, when they have to go over and over and over these various events, understanding them, reporting them, writing them down, and then writing them down some more, honing them until it becomes smooth. But you begin to live, whether it be Dresden or whether it's the rapes that occurred in these, you start living in the shoes of these people, that you start feeling what they did. And it's a vicarious feeling, and it's an awful feeling, as you'll agree.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even have to imagine what it was like to endure a firestorm. I know now.
Well, Tom, let's talk about the firebombing of all of these German cities. As you mentioned, Dresden was the most egregious example. It had the most amount of casualties, it seems. You put in the book that it was somewhere like 400,000 is the upper estimate that has been put forth. 400,000 people killed in a series of bombing raids on one city. This is more than Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined, is it not?
It is. And the lowest estimate that I found was the International Red Cross at 225,000. Interestingly enough, today some of the apologists for the so-called good war try to diminish the count. They try to stage it down into 35,000 maybe at the most. Yes, it was a terrible thing, they agree, but it really wasn't the numbers people are talking about. How do they know? They weren't there. I'm talking about Red Cross people who were there, German officials from Berlin who came in to try to stage a body count to find out how many died. And the lower range, 225,000, and the upper range, 400,000. I mean, we're quibbling over a couple of hundred thousand here. They were only Germans. But
Tom,
yes.
I've seen time and again going through some of this material concerning Dresden and other firebombings, I've seen it put forth as 25,000 over and over again, 25,000, 30,000. And
rich.
We have people acting as apologists for it. We even have Bomber Harris, who was later renamed Butcher Harris by many, who was in charge of these airstrikes. He came out, I think, 30 years after the event and said he would do it all over again.
That's in my definition, that's a fiend. That's a devil, that's a Satan, that's a fiend who knowingly would do what he did again, knowing what he did. And, you know, I've also seen, I read it today somewhere, I'm not sure where it was at, but one Allied estimate that 600,000 Germans died in the air war of World War II. 600,000. Give me a break. That many died probably in the last 4 months of the war.
Wow.
Yes, and that's what I mean by an attempt to diminish the crimes committed against Germany. And it
but
goes
you can't,
on to
you can't get arrested for that, can you? You can't get arrested for diminishing the death and suffering of German people. No, there's only one group of people that's protected historically like that.
Yes, and well, at least not yet. You cannot be arrested in that
right.
Beacon of Freedom, Germany today, occupied Germany, I should say. But no.
Tom, at Dresden, there wasn't any military objectives that they were hitting, they were trying to destroy. And in fact, there were 26,000 Allied POWs in Dresden. So these great heroes in the sky, saying that sarcastically, obviously, were incinerating their own people. Yeah. That's how twisted and sadistic and just unimaginably cruel these people were, who were ordering this and committing it as well. Some of them lamented what they did, but they still did it.
You know, the seeds for Dresden were sown at Yalta. That's when Stalin demanded that Eisenhower, FDR and Churchill do something overt, something radical, something extreme in the West to draw away these incredibly hard-fighting German soldiers that were mostly facing the East, trying to stop the Red Horde from getting in. And so Stalin demanded they do something. This was the something. Dresden, make an example of it. Kill a million women and children and see if that doesn't get the Germans' attention. See if that doesn't make some of the men desert to go back home. I think that was the rationale. But still, it doesn't take away from the fact. Stalin may have demanded it, but they didn't have to do it. FDR, the one of the bloodiest war criminals in American history. Churchill, certainly one of the bloodiest war criminals in English history. These two criminals basically agreed with Uncle Joe. They gave him everything he wanted. If Stalin had demanded to turn over all of Europe to the Soviets, I think they would have done it. He just didn't ask for all of Europe because they certainly gave him the lion's share of Germany and Eastern Europe. But no, this was, let's call it what it is. This was a group of gangsters, no better than the mafia, who were dividing the spoils of Europe. And so, yes.
This was at the end of the war, though. As things were really winding down, Germany had pretty much already lost. They would have won this war, the Allies, without doing this to Dresden. This was just, as you put it in the book, a crescendo of destruction. Now let's go back a little bit in time here. How long had this been happening, and how did it escalate to this level? The firebombing aspect, was the first real firebombing at Hamburg, or did they try it out beforehand?
To my understanding, Hamburg was the very first where they actually had a had a formula. They wanted to try out this formula. And the formula was send in 1,000 planes, 800 planes, who's counting, and blow to bits a city that was still mostly intact with all those wonderful old medieval wooden timbers that you're familiar with, to send in 1,000 planes, blast it with high explosives, blast it to rubble, it splinters. Then a few hours later, maybe half a day, send in another wave of planes, this time loaded mostly with phosphorus bombs, fire bombs, and try to ignite the splinters that were created. And this was, to my knowledge, the first attempt at this formula. Well, of course, it worked to perfection. Hamburg was destroyed, virtually destroyed.
Let's talk about the firestorm that ensues. What was it like for people who had basically, who had survived the first bombing and then had come back out thinking it was all over, and then they heard the sirens go off again, and the first bombing was bad enough. What was it like after this? What happened to these people as their city experienced a firestorm?
Well, you know, I've never gone through a bombing raid before. I've read accounts of the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese that have undergone B-52 bombing raids during the Vietnam War, and they talk about it's like the end of the earth. And I would imagine after the people passed through that original bombing raid, the high explosive bombing raid, felt the bombs getting closer and closer, and heard the whistling sounds as they actually hit the ground and explode and the blast, I would imagine when you finally came out of your air raid shelter, when the siren sounded, there were many people that had soiled themselves. Quite honestly, this is when you think you're going to die, you know, who's worried about soiled pants? So a lot of people, that's the reality. That's the reality. You came out and basically you were shell-shocked. You didn't know which way was up, which way was down, where was east, west, whatever. And your first instinct would be, of course, to find safety somewhere because this may happen again. But then you're worried about certain things like your own home or your children. Are they still beside you? The fires are everywhere. You hear sirens because the fire trucks are trying to come in and put these fires out, these flames. And then, you know, you're finally collecting yourself after an hour or two. And then, by damn, here comes another siren, meaning another air raid. And I suppose, Kyle, that you would probably, a lot of people lost their reason, thinking they had to go through another one of these. And they had no time to get out, so they had to somehow find their way back to those shelters. And Hamburg had air raid shelters, and so people finally had to crawl over the rubble, the bricks and the mortar and the in the roads and the streets.
And find the dead.
Yes, and the dead, of course. And the trolley car wires, the electrified trolley car wires. You know, it's dangerous to get back to the air raid shelter. Well, as you know, and as I know, and as, of course, the Germans, those who survived, finally found out, that was the worst thing they could have done, is go back to their shelters, because this next raid is a firestorm raid, a firebombing raid. And their job is to ignite the rubble that was created by the first explosive bomb raid. And the poor people who did get back to their air raid shelters, of course, they were walking right into ovens, because when the raid began and the fires started, 1,500 degrees in the center of the firestorm, of course, their shelter turned into an oven, and they were baked to death, rendered down into human fat. Nobody survived this. I mean, if you were back in your shelter in the middle of the town, and you know, this it's not, let's put it this way, this isn't some accident, this wasn't an anomaly, this was a deliberate, premeditated, concerted attempt to kill every man, woman, and child in Hamburg and Dortmund and Dresden and Berlin and every town they bombed. There was no more military value to most of these towns. They had already been destroyed, and now they're just trying to kill as many Germans as they possibly can. It's kind of the Morgenthau plan in action right now. The ones who won't die later after the peace, when the nation's been pastoralized, will die now. And this is it's the good war, don't forget. And so people that did not go back to their shelters, who were trying to escape the fire, the phosphorus falling on them, and actually the phosphorus would fall on a lot of people and burn them right through the skin. And it was very difficult to put out. But the heat became so incredibly severe that many people were stuck in the asphalt. The tar would melt and it would grab the people's feet. It would hold them into this stuff. And, of course, when you can't move, I mean, you're going to just burst into flames, which that many of them did. Thousands probably died just that way. Other people tried to escape into the canals, the numerous canals that that made Hamburg famous. And they died very quickly also in the canals from, well, let's face it, you have to breathe. And so you're breathing in this ferocious heat, and the radiation would kill you. And when they died, their bodies floated to the surface, and their corpses also caught fire because of the heat. The stone itself and some of the buildings would melt. That's how hot it got. The copper gutterings in the buildings would pour like molten lava down on people. We're talking hell here. And I think it's an aptly named book, Hellstorm.
Here's a quote from an RF crewman that you have in the book. There were people down there being fried to death in melted asphalt in the roads. They were being burnt up, and we were shuffling incendiary bombs into this Holocaust. I felt terribly sorry for the people in that fire I was helping to stoke up. Interesting he used the word Holocaust there, because by definition, that very much mm-hmm. is what was going on in these German cities. And the people who witnessed it, the Germans, the Allies, it had obviously a profound life-changing experience, an impact on for them. One person in particular was Kurt Vonnegut, who was in Dresden mm-hmm. when this occurred. And Kurt actually used to live close to where I did on Cape Cod. It's funny. He actually could have been the speaker at my graduation. We got to vote on who was speaker, and mm-hmm. I obviously voted for Kurt Vonnegut, but not enough people in my high school knew who he was, so they voted for maybe their ex-principal from elementary school or something. I was so upset because I was valedictorian. I was going to be able to speak on the same stage as Kurt Vonnegut, and I was very excited about this. But this changed his whole outlook on the world, on humanity, and it really influenced his books, obviously overtly in ones like Slaughterhouse-Five, but also in his other works. It's evident that this Holocaust he experienced in Dresden was something that, I mean, was just shattering. It shattered the minds of those who went through it. He survived in a slaughterhouse numbered five, and he saw what that good war was really about firsthand.
I'm sorry he couldn't come to hear your to your graduation. Man, you guys missed it then.
He died a few years later, too, yeah.
You know, for those who don't know much about Kurt Vonnegut, he was an American soldier captured in World War II by the Germans, treated very nicely. I mean, it's what the Germans did. They adhered to the Geneva Convention. 99% of American POWs survived to go back home. That's what you do when you capture an enemy and you're adhering to the Geneva Convention. You take care of your captives as you would want to be. But anyway, Kurt was captured, taken to Dresden, put in slaughterhouse number five with the other Americans, and they had to go through this terrible bombing like the Germans did. And when it was over, Kurt and others were I think they actually volunteered to come out and help. They felt so bad about this crime that was being committed on these people. A city of refugees, by the way, as Dresden was known then, the refugee city, because half the population of roughly 500,000 people were refugees from the east fleeing the Soviet army. And so we had a city of roughly 1.2 million packed, jam-packed in the center of the city. And the Allies also knew this. They knew that this town would be just crammed with human beings, mostly the old, mostly women, mostly children. We're not talking soldiers. We're not talking armaments industry. We're not talking even any flak, any AA on the outside of the city. This town is defenseless. It's one of the great masterpieces of the world. It was considered the Florence on the Elbe River, the Florence on the Elbe, because it was so beautiful. The architecture was so extremely beautiful. It was known throughout the world. Americans and British came there on their holidays. It was also known as a hospital city because a lot of the wounded and injured, not only soldiers, but many of them civilians, found refuge in Dresden. It had never been really bombed in the entire war. So here you've got the perfect setup. Stalin wants it bombed. FDR has no soul. The drunken Churchill has no soul. Why not give Uncle Joe what he wants? Let's just give him Dresden on a platter.
I think in addition to wanting to appease Stalin and wanting to kill as many people as possible, the helpless, the defenseless, I really do think that the amount of artwork and just European culture condensed in that city was reason enough for these people who hate European heritage to just blow it to smithereens. They wanted to get rid of as much of our priceless history as possible. And then, of course, what did they introduce after the war? All of their crap, degenerate art, all of their disgusting, mind-warping material. And what did we lose? We lost our connection to the past, our connection to greatness in these raids of destruction. Let's talk about what happened after Dresden was bombed time and again. They did it just like they did with Hamburg and other places. They first came in, exploded the whole place, and then set off their firebombs time and again, raid after raid.
Yes.
But it's also very interesting and telling what they did to the survivors, people who were just trying to figure out what was going on to get to safety. What happened to these people who had miraculously survived these repeated bombing raids?
Yes, the shocked individuals, the women and children and old men who miraculously survived not only the initial raid of high explosives, but the secondary raid of phosphorus and firebombs. They had sought refuge the following day, the sunny following day after the fires had started to cool, along the river, along the Elbe River, and in the park, a huge park in the middle of, actually not in the middle of the city, but off a little bit. And so tens of thousands of people found temporary refuge here. Well, guess what? When they're finally trying to locate their children and trying to tend to the wounds that they've received, that following day, that bright sunny day, they hear the air raid sirens sound again. Sure enough, here come the Americans in bombers and fighter airplanes. Americans bombing what's left, the rubble. The people in the park are bombed. And the American fighter pilots in the Mustang aircraft, like a video game, have a great time shooting the people as they're running along the river, in the park. It's bright, sunny day. They can see who it is. They can see the women. They can see the children. They can even see the animals in the zoo that have been let loose by the keeper because he wanted to save them. And so they're shooting everything, men, women, and children, with machine gun fire and cannon fire, and even the animals that are trying to get away. They're shooting these things down. We have got some really wonderful, heroic monsters here. I'm going to tell you, people that would do things like that. This is the so-called greatest generation that's doing this. One zookeeper saw an American chase down and kill the last of his giraffes, and he cried. He just started sobbing.
Well, Tom, not only was this insanity going on back then in the heat of war, it's not an excuse. It's not understandable to me what they did then, but that's pretty much the excuse that is given, that this was a war that they just wanted to end, so they needed to destroy the German morale. Bomber Harris, Butcher Harris would do it again. But if that wasn't sick enough, Tom, up until today, they continue to pour forth their hate upon the people of Germany and the people of Dresden in particular. They do this in Dresden at the memorial each year to the victims of the bombing. I see all of these different signs. A German in the chat, Marcus, had actually posted some of these earlier after I had posted one picture. This is Femin in 2013. I'm not sure if this is in Dresden, but it's about Dresden on the Memorial Day of February 13th. They're topless. It's not attractive whatsoever. It is disgusting because upon their bare tops, they have Antifa, meaning anti-fascist action, DD 13 February on one, and then on the other woman here in this image, it says, "Thanks, Bomber Harris." Thanking Bomber Harris for murdering so many hundreds of thousands of innocent German people. They're doing this to this day, Tom. Here's another one. I think this is written in this is written in German. I can't say it correctly, but it translates to, I think, "All good comes from above." It has a bomb falling, and it's to commemorate the bombing of Dresden. I see an Israeli flag behind. A couple more images here. We have a British-American communist flag all in one banner, and it says "Bomber Harris Superstar." Der Dankt D. I don't actually know what that translates to, but "No Tears for Krauts" is another one that I see here. So don't shed your tears for these Germans. They're obviously evil. They deserve this. And here's another banner, "Bomber Harris, do it again." What do you think about this this occurring up until this day? It wasn't enough to slaughter that many people at that time, but they're still celebrating it to this day and saying that it should be done again.
I think we're doing something right. If we've got these filthy pigs that are out doing such things like that, they are obviously concerned about what we're doing. I think we're doing something right. I hope that demonstration is larger next year or the following year. That means we're doing even more things right. Some year, we're going to show up, 10,000 of us, and let them dare do what they're doing right now. Let them dare. But right now, it's probably pretty good. Let them have their fun. Let them have their vicious depravity. They're basically showing what sadistic pigs they are right now. And I don't think they'd do it. It would be hard for me to stay put if someone did that to me in my face over there, knowing what I know. We're not talking whatever. Probably we ought to get off that subject. I get a little hot about certain things like this because it's very rare that somebody shows the depth of their depravity like these creatures you're talking about right now. And that's a very deep depravity that they're exhibiting in public, I should say. And I think somewhere somebody should have a photograph, a camera taking pictures of these people so that we can identify them at a later date.
Yeah. Well, let's continue to talk about the depravity. Let's move on to the next section.
There's plenty of depravity to go around, let me tell you.
We'll move from the Allied air massacre, and we'll talk about rape next. Let's start off by just discussing the directives that were given by the Jewish propaganda czar. I don't know if that was his official title, but he was the head of propaganda, I believe. Ilya Ehrenberg. What was he directing the Soviet soldiers to do to the German people as they moved into their territory?
Well, last time I looked, I think Ilya Ehrenberg was Stalin's minister of propaganda, a Jewish individual who hated Germans. Of course, he hated what Hitler was all about, what National Socialism represented. He was a communist Bolshevik, of course. And Ehrenberg, after the tide had turned and the Soviet Union was finally pushing Germany not only out of the Soviet Union but back to its very borders itself, Ehrenberg, being the hate-filled individual that he was, he started pinning various broadsides, various flyers to be dropped from airplanes onto the front lines of the Soviet army, encouraging his men. And you might say Ehrenberg was the numero uno Jewish commissar in Russia at the time. It was words of encouragement. In other words, it wasn't enough that the Soviet Union was about ready to invade Germany and do some terrible things. But Ehrenberg had to pour a lot of more gasoline on the fire to make sure that these were they understood what they were doing. Here's an example. He said in one of his flyers that fluttered down upon the front lines, "Kill them all, the men, the old men, children, and the women, after you have amused yourself with them. Kill. Nothing in Germany is guiltless. Neither the living nor the yet unborn. Break the racial pride of the German women. Take her as your legitimate booty. Kill, you brave soldiers of the victorious Soviet army, kill." Now, given that the average Soviet soldier was a very unsophisticated peasant boy from a village that probably had neither electricity or water, had been bled, actually, just like the rest of Russia, had been bled white by the Jewish Bolsheviks for the last 30 years, given that he was a rube, a hick, you might say, hearing words such as this, coming from a right-hand man of Joseph Stalin, What do you imagine that boy is going to do once he does get into Germany? Now, he may have a soul. He may have a conscience, like Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He may not do these things, but chances are at 18, 19, or 20, his soul isn't perfectly developed, and he probably will do some of these fiendish things. What Ilya Ehrenberg is saying in this note, and what he says 100 times over in other notes, is basically, it's your duty to kill, and it's your duty to rape. And after you've raped, kill some more. That's the duty. That's what we're demanding of you. As Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, it was almost a combat distinction to rape and kill.
Now,
that's sanctified. That's state sanctified.
It's funny. I had called him a propaganda czar. And obviously they didn't use those terms at the time. I was obviously confusing our governmental structure today, where we have unelected czars ruling over us here in America. It's just very, very weird to have czars, unelected czars over us. But yes, he was the minister of propaganda, and his job was to incite these Russians to violence and depravity and cruelty. And the Germans really massacred a lot of massacre in war against the Russians. Their had seen many of their comrades to the Germans, so they were looking for revenge, and he just stoked the fires even further. Now, please go ahead, Tom.
Well, also, I mentioned Ehrenberg quite a bit and the Soviet soldiers, but I don't mention the Americans and the Jewish propagandists in America, the filmmakers who depict the Germans as these arrogant, superior acting individuals that only deserve death. Let's face it, these are the most hateful-looking individuals on earth. The Japanese got the same treatment, of course, but the Germans. And so you've got both sides, basically, with Jewish propaganda being fed into the heads of these 18, 19-year-old soldiers. Also, let me say this about this pervasive rape that occurred, this spiritual massacre of German womanhood that I describe in the book and that we're going to describe in the movie, no doubt about it. This was pervasive. This wasn't a few random examples of rape. This was up and down Germany, one end to the other. It was occurring at night, day. It occurred indoors. It occurred outdoors. It occurred on park benches. It occurred in ditches, up against walls.
Little girls, women, grandmothers, great-grandmothers, no one was safe from this.
From 8 to 80, and let me also say something else. Now, the research for this book was eye-opening, was a revelation in many ways. As tough and brutal as the frontline Russian soldiers were, that is, the white Russians, these were almost always white Russians, that is, the Belarus, the Ukrainians, people like that, the ones we're familiar with today, the Putin type of Russians. These guys were tough. They committed all sorts of terrible crimes, like all fighting men do. But by and large, it was the rear echelon troops that garnered the most attention from everybody. When they're talking about rape, it's always the rear echelon that they're talking about the most. That's the Mongolians, the Asiatics, who are the rear echelon troops that are driving the trucks, that are herding the sheep and the cattle for food, that are driving the carriages that are piled high with plunder. This second echelon of troops, the rear echelon. Now, this, like any other army, that's virtually the way it is in every army I've ever researched, including the American Civil War. But these people who had weren't frontline soldiers, did not fight. They had more time to loot, to plunder, to drink, to go wild, and above all, to rape, and rape some more. Whereas the frontline soldier was too concerned about survival, going from door to door, kicking in doors, finding German soldiers, fighting, too worried about living another day, to worry about things, mere things like rape and booze. But this is, it's hard to imagine. You think, well, yes, there are some rapes going on. I'm talking about millions of women being raped millions of times. Most people have a real frilly notion about rape. They think, yeah, it's bad. I mean, it's the woman's forced to have sex, and then it's over, and then she's got to think about it and go have a test, perhaps. This is not that. This is wild, brutal, forced rape, and then more forced rape, a line building behind the guy right in front of you. The line's getting longer, one rape after another, and the woman starts bleeding. And eventually, many, many women, thousands, died from the rapes. It was so pervasive and so consistent. It just depended on how many soldiers were there. If there were 100, you got raped 100 times.
They gave them all sorts of venereal diseases, and they even gave them children as well. Imagine how terrible it would be to be raped 10, 20, 30 times a night, sometimes right in front of your own screaming child who might get killed because the Russian didn't enjoy that. The Soviet did not want a screaming baby there. So they'll throw him against the wall or do something even more terrible. But then to have to give birth to the product of this mass rape, it's just so terrible. It is so awful, and I feel so badly for the women who had to go through this, and they found no sympathy from anyone in the world except for maybe their own kin, who was also suffering the same fate. No one cared for them. They were just left to suffer and to die. It is astonishing.
Kyle, you've read the book now. I think you'll agree with me that absolutely the worst aspect of this book, in my opinion, is the pervasiveness of rape, how it occurs early, middle, and late in the book. It never stops. And if anybody is the victim in this war, it's the women. God bless them, because so many of them did not survive. And even those who did survive, we're talking a spiritual massacre of the German womanhood. And it should be also said that time and time again, it's the Jewish commissar that's leading the companies or the regiments, these political officers who are there to make sure that the soldiers behave like good communists and that they hate Germans and kill Germans and rape Germans. They're basically cheerleaders who travel along with the soldiers. And time again, these cheerleaders are encouraging their men to do the most terrible things. In fact, one of the more constant aspects of this was how when the second echelon of troops would blow into town, they'd immediately go to the church because they knew that's where women would hide for refuge. And of course, the commissars knew that. They'd take their men there. They'd get in lines. They'd start raping every woman there. Then the nuns, I mean, that was particularly nice for them to rape the nuns. They loved that. Anybody who got in the way would be killed or sawn in half, like many priests were for some reason. They were sawn in half with saws, literally. And okay, this may give you an idea of the mental aberration, the mental, for instance, and this is not an anomaly either. This isn't an aberration. This is not something that only occurred once or twice. It happened time and time again. Soldiers would line up to rape women on the streets or in hospitals, for God's sakes, when they were in the bed, line up to rape. And when the woman finally died from the raping, the loss of blood, I'm sure, that didn't mean the rape stopped. They would stand in line, even laughing, in broad daylight, on streets, to rape corpses again and again and again. That's what I'm talking about, the demonic. How do you put a term on something like this? And when they were finally finished, they would stick something up her vagina to signify that she's closed for business. How do you put a name? Do we have any words that can describe this kind of stuff?
No.
None that I know of.
No. I think even Hellstorm.
It doesn't
fit the bill. I mean, you tried to come up with something that is close, And that's what happened. Hell, in the way that most people think about it, just the worst possible torture and death imaginable, was unleashed upon the German people from the sky, from the ground, from the elements, from the sea. We can get to that later. Fleeing civilians, getting torpedoed and freezing in the ocean. It was from all directions, and there was seemingly no sanctuary.
And you know, Kyle, when I talk about the spiritual massacre of the German womanhood, it may sound like ethereal or rather, I'm at a loss for words tonight, but it may sound like I'm being rhetorical.
Sentimental.
Could be. But what I mean by that, what I mean by the spiritual massacre is, okay, let's look at it this way. Suppose this woman, a 35-year-old housewife, survives 500 rapes, 1,000 rapes, who's counting, survives the final end of the war. So what? How does she go back to being what she was before all this? How does she go back to being a housewife with kids, enjoying baking cookies with her kids? Or if she was a school teacher who was forced to perform oral sex for 40 or 50 filthy Mongolians in front of her students in the school, how does she go back after the war teaching school to these kids? That's what I mean by a spiritual massacre, a slaughter of the spirit.
I think the people who survived Dresden would be able to move past it and regather their life at least better than the women who suffered this fate.
I agree, but we have not gone through Dresden, so we can only surmise.
Yeah, that's only my guess.
Having seen people stuck in the asphalt, screaming for help and then bursting into flames.
You'll never forget that. That will haunt you for the rest of your life.
Yes, I would wake up every night for the rest of my life screaming in the middle of the night. And we're talking about, I'm going to let you ask the questions because they're just, you throw a dart at this book and you come up with something horrific just like this. But then, by God, that's what I had to do with this life I've been given, is basically tell the people what happened 70 years ago so that we never repeat this thing. You know, that old saying, it's another old saying about if we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it. How many times have you heard that? I've heard it hundreds of times in my life.
Yes.
Well, think about that. Think about this book. Think about that war. We're doomed to repeat this unless we learn from it. And for 70 years, there's no way we could have learned from it because it's been a secret, hidden under a mountain of lies and propaganda. Well, now we've got the chance to know about it, not just with this book, but more importantly with this film, and so that we never repeat this again.
Yes, I want to avoid any type of war like this ever again, but if it is thrust upon us, let us at least not lose it. And if we do win it, let us never act like the winners of World War II. Never, never act like those people.
I agree with you absolutely, my friend. This should never happen to anybody at any time, but no one should ever have to undergo this. Not even the creatures who committed these crimes.
I agree.
That's how terrible this was. Not even the Eisenhowers or the Ehrenbergs of the world or the Stalins or the dirty little henchmen on both sides in both armies who committed these crimes. It should not even be done against them.
Tom, let's talk about one of the most disturbing scenes that was painted in my mind in this book. And it occurred in Neustettin in February 1945. Where the Soviets came upon a woman's Reich labor service, and there was a Brazilian woman who was there who was observing what was happening. She was given some lenience in terms of punishment, but she was eyewitness to what happened to the women of the Reich labor service at the hands of the Soviets. This was just... It was very difficult to get through. Could you just give us something of a synopsis of what she experienced there?
No. And I'll tell you why. I've avoided that part of the book as if there were a disease ready to spring out and
it's crap that bad.
It is that bad. And it's, I've tried to not ever think about it.
Well, can we talk about it in general terms then? I think it was 2,000 women in total, young girls, and the prettiest first receiving the harshest treatment, who were tortured and mutilated one after another. And killed.
Yeah,
murdered.
Probably the birds were singing outside, and it was a nice sunny day. It may have been in the spring. I can't remember. The flowers.
February.
Yeah, a little early for the flowers, but the birds maybe, and the snow is starting to melt. It's probably, like I said, a sunny day. It's just too gory, too horrific, as if what we're talking about is not already gory enough. But this transcends virtually anything I have ever thought or read about, much less thought about. I can't put it, had it not been by a neutral observer. Let's put it this way. This entire book is from eyewitness accounts. It's not me talking. It's the people themselves telling what it was like, how these things happened, what it looked like to them, the victims, even the victimizers talking about it. And so
do the Jewish forces, the Allied forces, do they deny these things or just completely ignore them?
Oh, yes, I think it's a conspiracy of silence. It has been for 70 years.
Would they say, if, let's say we bring this to the public in a big way, like we plan to, would they come out and just say that account at New Stettin was just either exaggerated or completely fabricated, do you think?
No, because they cannot. It's established fact. It's not just me in a book writing this. It's there people reporting on this. Other people, German counterattack, for instance, in that same area, a German counterattack recaptured some of this very same area that you're talking about, and the women themselves ran to them, and they tried to stab some of the beasts who had done these things to them with knives and forks, and the German soldiers wouldn't let them do it because suddenly they were prisoners. But then when they found out what had really happened, the story kind of ends there, but it sounds like the Germans let the women have at them, basically, because of the things they did. We're talking, as you mentioned, thousands of young girls in the German labor force. These are not women who are involved really in the war. They're digging ditches, building fences, painting buildings, things like this. This is not... I even debated whether to put that rather long aspect of it in here. And
I think it's needed. I think it is needed. It's terrible to get through. It's shocking. But I think that's the depths of depravity.
Kyle, I don't know how you're going to portray that in the film because, it's... You know,
obviously, there's no footage of it. If there was footage of it, I would never show it.
No, I just the words, and then I don't know what to say. Pictures of beautiful young women. Well, there won't be these women, probably, or maybe they will if we research hard enough. But
so many beautiful people, smart, intelligent, promising people who could have made this entire world such a better place. If they hadn't been tortured, raped, and murdered, so many our whole cultural heritage had many different limbs. Let's say we're talking about this in a family tree. We had some of the biggest limbs on that tree just hacked right off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's gone to this day. It's never grown back.
Yeah.
It's not grown back, no matter what anyone thinks. Germany is not Germany anymore. And I want to say this too, right? I've been beating up the Jews in this last hour, and rightfully so. I don't take back anything I've said. But what kind of people are we? The Jews themselves weren't numerous enough to commit all these crimes. They had their henchmen. That's us Christians. That's Goyim doing those too. The Americans, the Russians, the British, the French. What kind of people are we that will so willingly commit these crimes when a Jew tells us to do that? I mean, who's the worst? Who is the worst of the two? The Jew who orders this or us who willingly do it?
Yeah. Well, I think that we need to deal most harshly with our own problem elements and take responsibility for them. And, of course, not be lenient or forgiving of people who have caused us so much suffering in the past, but they are what they are, and we should have known this.
That's absolutely right, Kyle. Well put. Well put. I I had two fathers who fought in that war and probably thought they were fighting on the side of good. One who fought as an island-hopping Marine in the Pacific, and the other was who actually kept the planes flying in Iceland and Greenland and places like that, England. These two contributed as much as they possibly could. If I'd known then what I know now and I were alive, I'd have never fought in that war. They would have had to imprison me or kill me, but I would not have fought in that thing. Absolutely not.
And there were so many voices of reason that were speaking up. Maybe not enough, not loud enough, but no. There were patriotic Americans who were saying at the time and beforehand, this is not a good war. You are fighting your kinsmen if you go and fight against Germany. And that is really what the American people, who are largely from a Germanic and Celtic stock, were doing, was murdering people just like themselves.
They swallowed hook, line, and sinker the propaganda. And we've talked about this before, the so-called greatest generation. Hell, they weren't even a good generation. They were the worst generation that America has ever produced because they went off and did these things with a head full of propaganda and never really gave any thought. They went and did it. And I'm beating up on the Russians, too, right now. The Americans, when they were rolling in on the Western front, these were some of the greatest savages of the entire war. They were shooting men and boys in the Home Guard down as soon as they stood up to surrender.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't taking any prisoners. The ones that did somehow fall into American hands were sent to the rear. And that, of course, was a death sentence. They were killed within a few minutes. But the rape in America, like one American sergeant said, we were also an army of rapists. So I'm not giving the Americans any break in this either, my own people.
Tom, the Russians, just like the Americans, were very similar to the Germans. They weren't as sophisticated and definitely not the Mongolian stock, but they were forced to participate in that war. The Russians suffered greatly in this conflict as well. Though they committed absolute atrocity against the German people, they suffered severely, and there was no room in Soviet Russia for someone who would not follow the orders of Stalin, who would not keep marching forward as they got mowed down. There was no surrendering. And actually, those who did end up in Allied hands, when they were turned back over in an instance of utter treachery on the part of the Allies, to the Soviets, these people were exterminated.
Yes, you're talking about the folks that fought under Vlaslav, who actually hated communism so much that the first chance they got, they went over to the Germans and started fighting against the communists.
Right.
That was one group. There were other groups. They're the ones that were actually caught or captured in battle and who were taken back to the German camps, or war camps. And by the way, Germany and Soviet Union had neither one had signed the convention, Geneva Convention. So Germans did not have to take care of the Russians. But they did. They did. They fed them, even though the Germans were treated. Let me say this too: many Germans were surviving. Also, they weren't just slaughtering each other. And so that brings out what you're saying: that there were many similarities. In fact, I was in Russia a couple of months ago, and I was stunned by how the people looked so much like me, or Germans, or Americans. I mean, this very same people, the very same folk. But back to the Russians that were captured after the war was over. Roughly, I think, 2 million Russians, either with Vlaslav's anti-communist army or people as far back as the original Russian Revolution who had fought on the side of the whites and who had fled when the Reds finally won and had lived in Europe for a generation and a half. These people, because Stalin wanted them returned, were returned. It's the greatest act of treachery in World War II and maybe in world history, because Eisenhower, FDR, Truman at the time, they willingly handed over every Russian citizen in their control. It's called Operation Keelhaul, and the treachery that was involved in this was just unbelievable, how they tricked these poor people, including the fiercely dependent and anti-communist Cossacks. Mm-hmm. These proud people were also sent back. And almost the moment they were returned, they were killed. Americans noticed that above certain warehouses would be bombers, Soviet bombers, flying low around and around to drown out the sound of the machine gun fire in these buildings.
Well, keel hauling, for anyone out there who's not familiar with this term, is when on a ship you would tie somebody to a line or a rope if you're on land. You tie somebody to a line and then throw them overboard in the front, and then they would get dragged underneath the ship. And that is a pretty good metaphor for what happened to these Russian people who were sent back to the Soviet slaughterhouse. And this is just another example of Allied treachery. And the Russians who had left the Soviet Union, they were killing themselves rather than go back to the Soviet Union. They knew what their fate was. Correct.
Yes, they did. Most of them did, of course, and times were – even had they not known they were going to be killed, nobody wanted to go back to this workers' paradise that had been bled white by the Bolsheviks for the last 20, 30, 40 years. But they also understood the nature of leadership in the Soviet Union, the commissars, the viciousness and depravity, and many of them tried to commit suicide even before they could be handed back over, but like jumping off ships, some of them coming from England would try to jump off ships, and the guards would kill them because it was their duty to hand them back over to Stalin. But that's just one aspect of this so-called good war that this book talks about. The slaughter at sea, a lot of folks think that the worst nautical disasters on Earth occurred, maybe the Titanic, 1,500 people dying in 1912 in that cold North Atlantic Ocean, or the Lusitania, perhaps, that was sank headed to Europe, that really helped America. It forced America's entry into World War One. 1,200 people died there. But now the world's worst nautical disasters occurred late 44 and early 1945, as German refugee ships were sunk by the Soviet submarines in the Baltic Sea, the frigid, ice-choked Baltic Sea. This was not a mistaken identity. There was no German naval ships of any size on the Baltic. So these larger ships, these former cruise liners and these freighters, filled, jam-packed with women and children mostly, and the wounded, fleeing the Soviet army, trying to get to Western Germany, away from the army, the fighting, were crammed on these ships. And for instance, the most notable of all the massacres was the Wilhelm Gustloff, which was a former cruise liner that Hitler had a fleet of cruise liners that would take his workers in National Socialist Germany to various ports of call as a reward for their work and as a reward for just being a strong, good worker German. But anyway, the Wilhelm Gustloff was crammed with something like 10,000 refugees the night it finally was sunk by a Soviet submarine with a couple of torpedoes in the midsection. And of the 10,000 people on there, something like only 500 survived.
Well, Tom, let's talk about the ethnic cleansing of Germans in general.
Okay, Kyle, I'm losing you a little bit here. I don't know.
The war. Okay, well, let's go to actually a musical break first, then, and we'll come back and discuss it then. Hopefully, the connection will be a little bit better. Okay.
Okay.
He sat in a room color of blood. He'd rule the world. He could. He'd sit and he'd stare at the minarets on top of the towers. For he was the beast as he hatched his new plans to gain power. Napoleon had taken before. They fought as the forces of light against the darkness in the holy war. One day they were looking out in the sunshine on the cold flowers. The next day they were freezing to death in the snow and the ice cold showers as the snow fell, covering the dreams and ideals. The snow fell, freezing the blood. And the snow fell, they had to keep warm for survival. And the snow fell, and defeated the beast on the rivals. And then came the deadly road back on the steps of their retreat. Cold like their bodies, but worse was the pain of defeat. And people who had hailed them once now turned and looked away. These people now knew that the beast was on his way. And the snow fell, covering the dreams and ideals. And the snow blood on the wheels, and the snow fell. They had to keep warm for survival. And the snow fell, and defeated the beast's only rival. Finally came back to the borders of your fatherland. Now enemies came, traitors everywhere at hand. Many people had fought and died, knowing that they had to win. And still it sickens my heart to see the picture of a red flag in Berlin in the snow. And the snow fell, freezing the blood on the wheels. And the snow fell, they have to keep warm for survival. And the snow fell, and defeated the beast's only rivals. Yeah, defeated the beast's only rivals. Defeated the beast's only rivals.
Welcome back to the Solar Storm. This is your host, Kyle. Thank you so much for joining me here this Sunday evening. My guest tonight is Mr. Thomas Goodrich, author of Hellstorm. And Tom, can you please tell people how they can purchase your book?
Sure. Amazon has it paperback. It also has an ebook, which, you know, Kyle, for the last 4 years I've been beating my head against a brick wall trying to sell out the publisher's inventory of hardbacks. And finally, that great day has finally arrived. So now I've got my own paperback on Amazon and the ebook. It's virtually the same book. Different cover is the only difference. Or people who want a copy of the book can actually I sell a paperback for $20. That includes postage. And they can drop that figure, $20, into my PayPal account, which is MT Goodrich. That's M as in Michael, T as in Thomas, mtgoodrich@aol.com. And I'll get a book in the mail to them ASAP, probably the very next morning. And so, yeah, you can go to that or barnesandnoble.com, booksamillion.com, but amazon.com is probably the best.
All right, great. And people, if you've been thinking about donating to me in the near future, I'd suggest you go and just drop $20 in Mr. Goodrich's PayPal. Get this book. You'll get a signed copy. Really, it's something that you need to go through. I know it's not the most it's not the easiest material to get through, but it's necessary. It is something that we need to know. Ignorance is not bliss. It is not. It's what allows for this kind of thing to happen time and again, and in ever-increasing severity as our technology improves. So this is one of those books, and this is going to be one of those movies that has the potential to change the world for the better so that people have an honest idea of what happens to the losers in this kind of war and who is controlling our world today and what plans they have for us.
You know, Kyle, let me interject and say that anybody who contributes, as we already know, they can also get the book that way, and they can also get the DVD that way. So that you can get the book and the DVD with a contribution. I don't know what your cutoff mark is, but still, they can do both those things. They can get the book and the DVD and still know that they have laid a brick on the road to truth and freedom, and that's exactly what they will be doing. If they contribute to this, get in on the ground floor and do something for our future. And this will be it, I guarantee you. But that's it. And I think the book and the DVD will be a wonderful package for anybody who does contribute.
Tom, let's just give the audience out there a little bit of a teaser of our plans for this. This DVD, this video, which will be released for free, as well on YouTube and possibly Vimeo and other sites. We want this getting out there to as many people as possible. This it will not possibly just be in English, but will be accessible to other people around the world. We're not going to give away too much just yet. We need to actually make it happen with all of this. But the plan is to distribute this information worldwide. Tom, what do you think the repercussions of this could be?
I think they'll all be positive, quite honestly. I think that my original plan, Kyle, once I realized the enormity of the crimes committed in this in World War II and then started working on the book, my goal was, and it remains, to warn the world, to warn them what happened then. And what's going to happen in the future unless we learn from this? This is going to happen again and again unless we finally understand what happened. I mean, you know, that old saying, we're back to that saying, we're doomed to repeat history if we don't learn from it. We did not learn from this because it was buried under an avalanche of lies and propaganda, movies and films and documentaries and lying books that basically told only the good war scenario and the greatest generation. My goal, Kyle, is I can't stop war, but maybe I can make war a little more civilized and less of a butchery. Stop. You know, if I had to do over again, I would have named this, I would have kept the name Hellstorm, but the I would have subtitled it "The Powerful Price of Propaganda," because this is all about propaganda. The propaganda got millions raped. It got millions tortured. It got millions murdered. It got a nation destroyed. It's got Europe basically in lockdown right now, a form of slavery. That's what propaganda did. That's how effective it was. I've got to say, too, programs like Renegade Radio, other programs I've been on, this is alt media, alternative media. We're circumventing the Jewish control that they've had for the last 100 years on communications. And I think once we create this and get this totally in our hands, that is this alternative media, then we will have to not go back to the propaganda of the bad old days as before, which caused egregious monstrosities like World War II. And that's another really wonderful thing coming up. But for now, basically, it's to stop the slaughter. And in the Middle East, I see the Middle East right now as the Muslims seem to be the new Nazis. I mean, they're being slaughtered. They're like animals. They're suffering through the same propaganda. It's just all over again. Think about Abu Ghraib. Think about the grinning hillbilly Americans that were torturing these people. Well, I describe that in my book also in Germany after the war, as you know so well. Mm-hmm. Virtually the same people were doing the same things, only they were much more demonic, I think, in their torture.
Well, it's interesting that Jews have enabled and encouraged all of these different wars in the Middle East that have created so many different refugees who are now in Europe and America and elsewhere, and who are just not compatible with the society because, contrary to what Jews tell everybody, multiculturalism is not actually beneficial for us. We like being around our own people for the most part, having homelands. But what we're doing is denying Muslims a safe place to live in their own countries because of all of the different intervention and CIA operations and Mossad operations and just bombing these people back to the Stone Age. They are having to seek refuge and taking advantage of these different opportunities as the gates have been opened up wide for them. But it's now them in Europe who is this anti-Semitic force that Jews are complaining about now. They're saying Europe has become anti-Semitic again. And they even acknowledge that it's mainly the Muslims in Europe who are causing this. And they openly also are the ones who are for those immigration policies. So what they're doing seems to be either biting them in the ass or unfolding perhaps in the way that they've wanted it to, so that they just create conflict after conflict and are able to look like the victim. While Gaza is being bombed to smithereens using phosphorus and other genocidal methods, they're complaining about the persecution because a synagogue got attacked in Europe, and their feelings got hurt somewhere. They're using this Muslim supposed anti-Semitism to make themselves seem like a victim in the world while they're committing war crimes. It's of course just a smokescreen, but we're seeing the same thing happening yet again. And now also, Tom, white people have been put forth as the new kind of terrorist. This isn't anything new. It's been going on for years now. And I'm thinking specifically of people like Timothy McVeigh, and more recently, some other supposed white nationalist killers. But they're portraying white people now as the terrorists, these Nazis who shouldn't even be allowed to speak because our words in themselves are just so inherently hateful and violent that they need to be censored with hate speech laws. They are waging war upon us, and if you are a Nazi in any way, shape, or form in this society, and a Nazi is anybody that they don't like, this Jewish power structure, they're going to wage war upon you, and that's what we're seeing unfold. Any thoughts on that, Tom? I know it was something of a long diatribe there.
No, I try like anyone else to make sense of the world. This Jewish power grab in the Middle East, in which they an enemy raises its head and Tel Aviv points, and the American pit bull Uncle Stupid dutifully runs in and destroys whatever rock pile Israel points at. This has been going on for 20 or 30 years now. That's understandable. I mean, I understand that part of it. America destroys, Israel comes in, carpetbags that nation, as they've done ever since the American Civil War. They come in and buy things for a song. That's how various Jews get their heads cut off, like Danny Pearl and Nick Berg and people like that, because they're carpetbaggers running loose, as they've done throughout all time.
I think they did that in the Soviet Union, too, when that came down.
Yes, in Ukraine, I'm sure it's going on right now, too, as well. This power grab, the most recent Syria, when the Jewish black intel, they tried to say that Syria was Assad was gassing his own people, and they tried to make a big worldwide issue out of that so that America would come in and bomb the hell out of Syria. And of course, that would lead right to the road would lead right to Iran after that. Well, guess who stepped in? And guess who has become the new world Hitler? That's Putin. Putin stepped in, cast his long shadow across the entire Syrian affair, and warned basically with his shadow that let's don't get too carried away with this, guys.
Well, I'm not pro-Putin in any sense, because he's made criticism of the Red Army mm-hmm. illegal and questioning the Holocaust also against the law in Russia. But it is interesting to see what happened after the United States and Israel, greater Israel, could not go to war directly against Syria, even though Israel openly bombed Damascus and the United States is currently bombing Syria. Well, then, of course, the Ukrainian conflict erupted. So Russia got tied up. And what emerged also was ISIS, which I've gone into most notably on my last show, and people can check that out. But two different conflicts arose after Syria was kind of taken off the table for further attack and direct attack. And so it's tying up Russia and also shifting the American opinion to get people herded in the right direction, saying, oh, yeah, we've got to go kill these Muslims because they're a direct threat to our very existence. What I've actually come to see, Tom, is that the propaganda line that's being put forth is that we need to hate Muslims when they're in their own countries dealing with their own affairs, but we need to love them and embrace them when they're coming and trying to impose their way of life, their extreme way of life, the extremists, upon Western nations. So hate them when they're in their own countries, but love them when they're in ours.
Yeah, we're catching the worst of both worlds here. We go over and slaughter them, and then, of course, what does the normal person do? They try to get out of the slaughter fields. And where do they go? Any place that's safe, whether it be Europe, America, Canada, whatever. And so we're creating this tidal wave of illegal immigration to Europe and Canada and America because of the wars we're creating over there. I try to see the world in simple terms. I don't – to suggest that somebody had this grand plan in mind, look, let's blast the hell out of the Middle East, and then we'll allow these people to invade the United States and Europe, all the white countries on Earth. I see this as just something that happened. I don't see it as any great plan. If I did, I would have to think that the powers that be, that is, those in Tel Aviv and Israel, are all-seeing, all-knowing, prescient individuals who actually maybe are the superior race of Earth. I don't see it that way. In fact, it's proof, this most recent Gaza genocide, that these people make some terrible mistakes. And that was one of them. Boy, that was a terrible PR stunt, let me tell you. Anybody with eyeballs could see that this was no war. Calling Gaza, what happened in Gaza, a war, is like calling a massacre a misunderstanding. This was a slaughter fest, and the world saw it. They saw the true face of Israel, and seldom have they seen it as in such unblushing terms, where the population is out celebrating and applauding as the Israel Defense Forces, let's call them Israel Offensive Forces, target children playing soccer on the beaches, or target churches or playgrounds or parks where mothers are with their babies. And they're laughing. They're celebrating this. The world sees this. That's a terrible public relations stunt. I'm sorry.
And you know what? This isn't even as bad as some of the atrocity stories that the Nazis supposedly committed. What Israel's doing right now and has been doing is even worse than they've been saying that how the Nazis treated them.
Well, I think honestly, let's go back to World War II. I think I grew up like everybody else, believing in the so-called Holocaust. I had nothing else to go by. I had to believe it. Can this many people be wrong? Well, as I got older, I found out that yes, indeed, they can be wrong. They can also be liars. And I think, first of all, I know the Jews had a tough time in World War II. I wouldn't want to be dispossessed. I wouldn't want to be thrown into a concentration camp. And I wouldn't want to have to take showers with other people and blah, 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 and on. But were 6 million people killed? That's a joke. That's a real joke. Let me say this. The most organized and the most efficient people on earth, the Germans, had the entire population of Europe in their control for 4 years, going on 5 years. They could have done anything they wanted with that. Had there been a deliberate policy of extermination of the Jews, they would have been exterminated. There wouldn't have been hundreds of thousands left alive in the concentration camps and running around the world right now in Israel, in the United States and Canada, or the ones that came right after the war and opened up their own death camps for Germans and the civilians and the soldiers and tortured them in the most incredibly bestial ways imaginable.
Let's talk about that, Tom. Let's get to the real death camps.
Oh,
of
brother.
World War II and afterwards.
You know the ones we're talking about too, don't you, Kyle?
I do. And from what I read in your book, and this makes total sense, when you realize what the rationale was, it wasn't until the war was really over that the camps, the prison camps, became legitimate death camps because the American forces wanted to get their prisoners back, even though they had bombed them in Dresden. They wanted to get as many of their men back as possible. Otherwise, the people back home wouldn't be all that happy about it. And some of them actually had a patriotic feeling about it and weren't just sick, twisted individuals. But once the war was ended, they didn't need to worry about repercussions upon their own soldiers. So the Allies really let loose with their genocidal plans.
The Germans that fell into the hands of the Russians in the east were turned over to the concentration camp folks that were released, and they opened up their own death camps. Now, Americans, we also had our death camps. Eisenhower's death camps are notorious, thank goodness. We know quite a bit about it. Eisenhower allowed anywhere from 800,000 to 1.5 million men, I think that's the going statistics right now, to die from hunger, starvation, dehydration, die from sickness, from the elements, allowed them to die. And that's all I can say. Disarmed, helpless, German POWs in these filthy, dirty, muddy camps where there's no protection whatsoever.
Fields.
And they're not a lot. They're not given any food, even though the International Red Cross wants to bring in trainloads of food to these helpless prisoners. Eisenhower forbade it.
They weren't given any water right by a clear river, correct?
Right. Yes, there are camps right beside the Rhine River, and you've got men dying from dehydration that are drinking their very own urine to survive.
Well, this isn't letting someone die. This is murdering them.
It is. In a sadistic way, it's murdering them because the poor devils that had carved out holes in these camps to try to find some shelter from the cold and the rain, many of them became, we're talking about dysentery. We're talking about, diarrhea is dysentery, and other typhus, other diseases, and they can't even crawl out of their holes. So the Americans bulldozed them while they're still alive in their holes.
It's not even murder. That was incorrect. It's torture and murder because just shooting them, as they did in a number of different instances, as you mentioned before, they would just kill surrendering Germans, especially if they were SS, and torture other ones and do all sorts of different things. Putting them out in these fields to die, to just go wither away and be exposed to the freezing cold, the rain, and just be living in their own filth. This was torturing them. This was not civil and humane and was very much a war crime, but it was being covered up then, and it's covered up to this day for the most part.
Yeah, yeah. Eisenhower had the United States had a wonderful propaganda machine rolling, and they, let's face it, that's when the silence began. That's what we're talking about right now, 70 years later. The silence began with things like Eisenhower's death camps. Also the slavery, basically selling out these Germans basically to any nation that wanted them for a certain price, and they would be virtual slaves, sometimes as long as 10 years. I've actually sat across dining room tables and talked to former slaves, German soldiers who were slaves in Scotland and Canada for 10, 15 years after the war. Slavery. You know, that's verboten in the Geneva Convention. The hell with the Geneva Convention. It's a piece of paper. The Americans wiped their butts with them. That they didn't care less about the Geneva Convention. But anyway, in the Soviet sphere of influence, you know, death is death. Starvation, torture is torture. But there was a special breed of individual in the Polish death camps that were reserved for the Germans. By and large, this was Jewish leadership in all of these camps. So they already had a vested interest in punishing the Germans, and now they finally have hundreds, thousands of them in their control. These camps were, to call them death camps is incorrect. Let's call them torture camps. Death was not a part of the package in this. The idea was to keep them alive to continue the torture, and that's what they did. The tortures, we avoided talking about what happened to these thousands of girls. And this is probably a good place to not talk, too, because the torture is so, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Dehumanizing, demeaning. They don't even fit what was actually going on. We would need to invent new words to be able to really describe.
The scale of depravity has never been witnessed in the world before. The scale of the sadistic depravity. This is something, if you sat around for the next year trying to come up with the worst torture you could put on your worst enemy, you still wouldn't come up with this stuff. That's how off the charts this type of torture depravity is. And the idea is to keep them alive or to kill them in the most amusing and, you know, the guy that was forced to swallow the toad. You remember that?
Yeah.
Okay, that gives people an idea of what we're talking about. So we can move on from that.
That's a mild one, too.
Yeah. You know the other ones, too, I'm talking about.
So the torture of people went all the way from the youth serving as the last defense of Berlin all the way up to the top ranks of the German command. They were dealing with these people ruthlessly, and then outside of the military force, outside of the National Socialist Party as well, outside of even the people living within Germany, even just German people who had been living in other countries outside of Germany, where there had been Germanic villages for many, many hundreds of years, these people are also subjected to the repercussions that the Allies were enforcing of being the losers in the Second World War. Can you talk about the ethnic cleansing that occurred to these Germanic people living outside of Germany?
Yes, a lot of Germans lived beyond the borders of the Reich. They were welcomed in by their countries, these various countries, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Yugoslavia, Romania, Bulgaria, people, countries like that. Because the Germans were such industrious farmers, generally. That's what they wanted. They wanted a population like the Germans to come in and grow this wonderful wheat and corn that they were so notorious for growing. And so that's how hundreds of years before the Germans found themselves living in places like Czechoslovakia. But at the end of the war, the expulsion of all ethnic Germans from these areas was demanded by the populations. And we had roughly 11 million people just uprooted almost in 5 minutes. Some people were forced to get out of their homes and not pack a thing. Just get the hell out of your home, and where you go is your problem, but go. People had to go back west, of course, toward Germany. They sure as hell didn't want to go toward Russia. And so you've got, within a matter of weeks and months, you've got 11 million people, mostly the old and infirm, the women and the children, on the roads in the middle of winter, trying to reach some safe haven. Going back, can you imagine going back to Germany that's utterly destroyed? I mean, that's your safe haven. That's your point of refuge. You're going back to ground zero. But they did. And what they had to endure, of course, they were robbed every step of the way. They were raped also. They were murdered by the sides of the road. Their babies were killed. Some of them were taken out and forced into sexual slavery. 11 million people. By the time it was all over, roughly 1.5 to 2 million had died. And this is, you know, taking isolated by itself, this would be considered one of the greatest war crimes in world history. The deliberate, malicious uprooting of a people with almost no preparation. In the dead of winter, many of these people were thrown out in the dead of winter with virtually nothing. That's basically consigning millions to death, which they did. They died. And then they had no place to go once they got to Germany. So this alone, it seems rather benign compared to the other atrocities committed. But it wasn't. For instance, the hideous atrocities that occurred in Prague. The Czechs had a special hatred of the Germans. Apparently the Germans had lorded over the Czechs. According to the Czechs, the Sudetenland Germans had been an affront to the average Czech. And so they had a very special vendetta against the Germans. And hell was literally let loose, of course, in Prague and many other German villages. In the eastern part of Czechoslovakia, it's hard to say some of the ugliest atrocities of the war were committed there, but it's a fact. This was, it was like the Roman Colosseum. When they took them to the soccer stadium, hundreds and thousands of Germans, it was like a day at the Colosseum, Roman Colosseum. People were slaughtered right in front of the audience's faces. Women were raped. One woman had her belly cut open, the child ripped out, and a dog thrown inside of her belly. The people, I'm sure they got a kick out of that. You know, I've been to Czechoslovakia, and the people, again, they look like me. They look like us. They act like us. They like beer, for God's sakes. They like to laugh. In the hell overcomes these people? What possesses them?
I want to be somewhat specific here. I might have been misleading when I said Germanic people, because Germanic includes the Dutch and English as well. But yeah. were these German-speaking people in those lands, correct? And they considered themselves Germans, although they were living outside of Germany, correct? But also, were there persecutions of Germanic-type people? I know that they went after the good-looking, blonde, Aryan types. The hardest, it seems, correct?
Yeah, well, yes. In the Jewish death camps in Poland, a person with blonde hair was the first to suffer. But anybody who spoke German or was a German, ethnic German, could expect the same. But, you know, I don't even touch upon the allies of Germany, the Italians and the French, the Vichy French, the people that – I really don't talk about the various SS units, the Waffen SS, that were European volunteers, probably the best fighting force the Earth has ever seen, including the Spartans. The Waffen SS was an incredible fighting force. The Esprit de Corps – and the Waffen SS was incredible. But, for instance, the Italians, Americans raped their way, and the British raped their way, the colonialists, that is, raped their way up the Italian peninsula. Italy suffered grievously, too, let me tell you. It's just that I don't cover it at some point you have to draw the line.
Right. Yeah. Now the Germanic fighters of the Waffen SS, that would probably be the more accurate term for them, is Germanic rather than the actual Germans in Czechoslovakia and Poland. But were they treated with the same kind of cruelty as, let's say, the SS officers of the Reich, or were they given some more kind of leniency? No. What was the policy towards those fighters?
No, the propaganda was so severe, so extreme, that anyone who fought for the Germans could expect the worst. The Waffen-SS, yes, the Waffen-SS, they had a tattoo. What was it? Under their left arm, I think, the SS... Or was that the German? Anyway, no, time and time again, they were slaughtered. For instance, a group of French SS in the Waffen-SS were captured by General Leclerc, the French general who found himself in Germany at the end of the war. And there is a famous picture of him interrogating them on a road as these young boys, basically. They're young Frenchmen who fought for National Socialism, European Nationalism, let's call it what it really was, European Nationalism. And they had seen much, of course. The French SS were some of the best fighters in all of Germany, period. They fought toward the end around the Reich Chancellery. They were some of the last to surrender. And some of the Spanish, too, by the way. But this photograph shows Leclerc interviewing these young kids, probably 17, 18, 19, 20. And Leclerc makes a comment. He said, what are you doing in these German uniforms? And one of the kids said, well, you look very snappy, General, in your American uniform. And Leclerc, with a wave of the hand, had them all shot right there.
Mm. Yeah. So they really... put forth their greatest cruelty towards anybody who was associated in any way, shape, or form with not just the National Socialist Party or Germany itself, but anybody who had been somewhat affiliated with them, who could be even closely not even closely associated with them.
Go ahead. Every German would have a story. If they were, let's say we were talking 30, 40 years ago, and a lot of the Germans who experienced this were alive, virtually every German would have a book inside them. I sincerely mean that. That war touched every German. And if you were a woman, I think you know what the odds were that she experienced. To think that a German woman on the Western Front somehow had a day in the park simply because it was the Americans and Brits coming through. Hardy, har, har. No. I have seen very little difference between the actions of the Americans and the Russians. Now, I will say this. The British, of all the forces, did seem to comport themselves probably the best of all the Allied forces, the British. Even the Germans point this out, although there were some terrible things. In fact, I noticed one of your films, I believe that's a Brit who's beating these Germans up as they're trying to disarm them. And he's actually beating them up as they run by, kicking them. It may be American, but that crap's not supposed to happen in a civil war, so to speak, a war that's fought with the rules of land warfare. But the SS generally were, back to the SS, they were pretty much killed outright. In fact, there's that one scene, as you remember, a guy's talking about the Americans coming into town. And they're in hospital beds. And he's talking about they're killing all the SS out there. And these guys, can you imagine what they've got to do to get out of there? I mean, it's... The Americans are looking at the tattoo under their arm, and if they've got their tattoo, well, they'll kill them. And that's basically the way it went for the next several months, basically killing. For instance, you don't have to be a soldier. You didn't have to be a Nazi. You could just be A German, a successful German, or a prominent German, or not a prominent German. Let's Leni Riefenstahl, for God's sake. She was, at the time, and maybe to this very day, still the greatest filmmaker the world has ever seen, because she was a pioneer. She was a tremendous artist. She created Triumph of the Will, which looked like a Nazi propaganda piece, but she was not a Nazi. She was proud that her nation had come back from the vicious Versailles Treaty, that had arisen from the ashes of World War I and became this superpower giant. Almost overnight, she was incredibly enthused by this, just like every other German was. She had created this film. She had 1936, she created Olympia on the World Olympics, held in Berlin. What happens to Leni when the Americans roll in? She's hauled away no less than 7 times. She was arrested, tortured every damn time. No doubt she was raped numerous times. She was beaten. We're talking Leni Riefenstahl. That's sort of like, Martin Scorsese, American director, being just because he makes good movies, he's been tortured and beaten up. I don't know if anybody escaped that war, quite honestly. I've talked to people who were kids at the time, and they have horrible stories. You know the accounts of that I've got in the book about these kids that are stealing for a living at the end of the war in occupation, mm-hmm. and that they're caught. The one kid that was caught by the British, this fat British major, and he beats him up right in front of all of his men. Remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who's watching this, this Brit with his soul still in his heart, in his head, by the way, couldn't help but admire the little kid because he wouldn't even cry. There were tears coming out of his eyes, but he would not cry. Being beaten up by this big, brutal British major. That's a child, man. And the picture doesn't get any better. As you know, this isn't a book about happiness. When people buy this book, this is the only book I've ever said. I've never said, I hope you enjoy it. The rest of my books, I have said that. But not this one. I'd like to say, I hope you get sad, then I hope you get damned angry, and I hope you decide to do something. And by the way, for the folks out there listening who have read this book or who may read this book, I ask you that don't just put the book away up on a bookshelf and allow it to gather dust and then go back to watching sports. Please do something. Pass the book on, if nothing else. If that's the least you do, well, so be it. Pass it on to somebody who will read it. I wish you would get active. I wish you would, because once you know the truth, in my opinion, if you know the truth and don't do anything with that truth, you become an accessory to the crime, in my opinion. Mm. And don't become an accomplice to this dark crime that was committed.
Tom, I'd like to open up the phone line and see if anybody can call in. It's 347-633-9657. Again, 347-633-9657. Do you have any total figures in terms of population, of how many Germans were alive before the war and how many had died during it and after it? What kind of loss of life are we looking at here?
Well, I think, wasn't it around 60 or 70 million? Isn't that for Greater Germany? Those are the ones, of course, in East Prussia, Silesia, provinces in Germany that were later carved out away from Germany. 60 or 70 million. And the Germans, I don't have a feel for the number. Let's put it this way. The going rate right now as far as death from the air bombing alone is something like either 400,000 or 600,000. That is grossly underestimated, I'm telling you. And it's for a very good reason, of course. They want to minimize the crime. I would think somewhere around 2 to 3 million people died from the air terror, the air bombing. I don't have anything to base it upon except Dresden and Hamburg, things like that, with their figures. Let's say 250,000, the low range, died in Dresden. That's a day and a half of bombing in one city. Can you imagine the rest of the Reich, the rest of Germany, the thousands that were killed in even the smaller towns? So you take away, let's just say 2 million died in the air terror. Another 2 million soldiers died. I don't have a figure on that either. Let's say 1 million No. Let's say 5 million soldiers were marched off into captivity. That's probably correct, pretty close. But let's say another 9 million came in from these other places, the ones who were expelled from the countries we were just talking about. So Germany actually gained some people, if you see what I'm talking about. There's 8 mm-hmm. million. But I don't know.
All the ones who starved and
it could easily be 20 million, Kyle, for all I know. I just don't have a figure. And the Allies won the war. Let's face it. They can juggle the books to their heart's content. They can say anything they want. Hell, there may only be 40 million people in Germany today. I'm not sure. I don't know. But, you know, at some point, the numbers probably don't.
We've got a chatter, Sygard, saying that the current lie total for civilians and military is 7,375,000. Mm-hmm. So that's their lowball estimate here, and I would imagine the way that they exaggerate things in terms of, let's say, the Holocaust trademarked there, in terms of making their own casualties well inflated, that this 7.5 million figure could be a few times that.
I've never bothered to, I'm ashamed to say, I never bothered to really look at the figures, the facts and figures of this. I guess you can attribute that to the fact that I'm more concerned about that grain of sand than the world, so to speak. I'm more concerned about the individual than the greater numbers out there. Somebody should do that, though. That's interesting. The Russians, I think they always talk about like 20 million died, and they call it the Great Patriotic War. And that's not hard to understand, Kyle, as you know from reading the book, when they have these enormous mass waves that basically some of them don't even have weapons. The commissars are shooting them if they try to run. They've got to attack. They're mowed down in their thousands by the Germans. Germans felt that was murder. They thought it was murder to kill these people that were just running towards them. And so, you know, you could come up with 20 million dead pretty quick when you're allowing them to be slaughtered like that. And then bolting them down in their tanks. Isn't that quite a deal? So that they can't surrender, they can't retreat. They've got to go ahead and win, or they're just going to die in their tanks. Remember the accounts of the Germans trying to rescue them out of their tanks when the anti-tank crew hit that T-34 and they couldn't get the screaming Russians out of the tank?
Oh yeah, and on the Western Front, you had the Americans in Sherman tanks being burned alive. It was a death trap. And the Germans were having to face off these invaders who, because of the Jewish forces that instigated that war, they had to stave off the American invasion. The Americans had no business being in that war, really one way or the other. But if they were in it, it would seem logical that they would be on the side of the Germans. But in any event, the American forces, having no real regard for the enemy's lives or their own, sent them off to die, be burned alive in Sherman tanks against the Germans.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's, as you know, I like detail when I'm writing a story. It's a history book. History is more than just the big picture. It's the little things, too, that make it. As you know, when the Americans finally started fighting the Germans, they were really interested to know how well they fought. They wanted to hear the German tell them that they were great fighters and tough men, brave and all that. And one German they captured in the fighting in France, they asked him, don't forget the Italians were the German allies. And in North Africa, the Italians surrendered, like sheep. They just throw down their guns and surrender immediately by the thousands, tens of thousands. Mm-hmm. And so they were more of a liability than an ally, quite honestly. But this American officer asked the German prisoner, what's the German impression of the American soldier? And the German was hesitant to ask or to answer. And finally he said, you really want to know the truth? And the American did. He said, we think of you as you think of the Italians. And you can imagine. Now, that man may have, I don't recall, but he may have been beaten pretty bad for saying something like that. The Germans were more than a match, even in the late stages of the war, for the American GI and the British Tommy. They had no problem on any battlefield where the numbers were anywhere near the same. The Germans, the results were always the same. The Germans just rolled over them. It was on the Eastern Front, though, where the Germans had to throw the bulk of their resources, men and materiel, because that horde coming in from the East was the one they really wanted to stop. The Americans, honestly, that was a sideshow. I don't care how many Jewish movies are made in America about the Glorious Bastards or the whatever the new movie coming out. That was a sideshow. The Americans and Brits got the B team in that one. But yet the B team still held them off. And had the Russians just suddenly stopped fighting, there is no doubt whatsoever the Germans still had the resources and the will to drive the Americans and British right back off the European continent.
From what I've been able to research, it actually seems like it was the American taxpayer who enabled the Soviet Union to keep fighting and not to fall initially in Operation Barbarossa through the Lend-Lease program. And without that American aid going directly to fuel the Soviet Union, it would have been all over.
Boots, butter, bullets, tanks, planes, everything. The Soviet Union didn't have the industrial capacity to fight that war. And, the Americans, FDR being the admirer, the fawning sycophant of Stalin, he would have given him Fort Knox, I think, if Stalin had asked. But it's all a revelation to me because I did grow up believing in the good war thing, the American GIs chewing their gum and throwing Hershey bars to kids at the sides of the roads as they rolled through on their Sherman tank through Germany and France. And I bought into that.
Treated as liberators, yeah.
Yes. Well, even the French didn't treat the Americans as liberators. Hell, the Americans were killing the French just like they were the German. That's also one of the stories that needs to be told. I've ran across so many French people.
We can keep going past the 2 hour mark here. We'll go into the archive. It's streaming out over at renegadebroadcasting.com. It'll be recorded as well. It's just if people want to call into the show, they have to do so in the next minute here. It looks like a few people might be trying to get on the air.
Okay.
But Tom, please wrap up with whatever you were talking about there.
Well, there's so many aspects, so many ramifications of World War II that still need to be explored. Yeah, I've written a book, and I'm pretty proud of this book, quite honestly. I see it as right now it's the only monument to the victims of this monstrosity, this butchery, this massacre. But you're living proof that there are more on the way, and thank goodness. And but simply because I write this book, there are so many things that can be done and talked about. I'm working on a book right now, rather slowly working on the book, a companion book to Hellstorm on what happened to Japan during World War II. And it was every bit as bad as this that happened to Germany.
The Japanese were killed in great, great number and very ruthlessly. And they're also made out to be the villains up until this day in different propaganda movies. They're still killing the Japanese, just like they still kill the Germans in the movies. They're still killing the Japanese.
Yeah, if anything, it was very difficult to transform a German into an animal because, let's face it, 50 million, 60 million of us have Germanic blood in us in America. And so that they had to try the Nazi aspect, the superior strutting, monocled German officer to create that level of hatred enough to go over and do bad things in Germany. But the Japanese, of course, they didn't look like us. They were small. They had buck teeth. Well, anyway, the stereotypical Japanese looks more like a monkey. From my research, you would just be astounded by some of the depictions of Japanese. Not only the visual description, but the verbal description of the Japanese. It's unbelievable. It's things we have to avoid whenever we get into another great conflict. In fact, we need to avoid it right now. This same propaganda machine is working on the Muslims, trying to create them as some sort of animalistic. Like, hey, look, these people are fighting for their homeland right now. I'm no Muslim apologist, but hey, who's doing the invading? Who's doing the attacking? Who's doing the killing? Who's doing the raping? Who's doing the imprisoning? Who's destroying one Arab nation after another? It's us and Israel. It's Israel telling us to do it, and we're doing it. So who is the animal in this? Who's the attack dog? I think it's us, guys. And do you blame any Muslim for strapping on a body belt or a bomb belt and blowing things up? I mean, that's the best they can do. That's their technology. And to call them bloodthirsty animals. Now, their head chopping off, I've heard various things about that. It's horrible. It's hideous. But, hey, I'm going to tell you what. When Israel was attacking Gaza, a lot of Gazans lost their heads, too, in bomb blasts and hissing shrapnel that just decapitated them. Heads get lost, whether you're cutting it with a sword and or a knife or a bomb blows it off. So let's not just be looking at one aspect of this, the beheadings, which are horrible. Don't get me wrong. But the war is a horrible thing. And so things like this happen. Anyway, I'm going to.
I agree. We need to end the influence, the power and control of those who profit from our destruction. They consider us all to be goyim, cattle, slaves, and I think that we need to find out that there's a lot more that is common between our interests than that which separates us. As long as we're allowed to have the control of our own lands. And not be subverted by alien forces. So I think that once we really take control of our own destinies, we'll be able to find more peaceful solutions in this world. But when there are war profiteers and just criminal elements running all of these different Western nations, we're only going to see more death and destruction. Tom, let's go to the phone line.
Okay.
All right, we've got I think this is Wodian Krieger on the line. Hello, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi.
Questions or comments?
Oh, I got two questions. I was wondering, is it possible to get the book Hellstrom in hardback still? Or is it...
No, I'm sorry. Well, if you go on Amazon and you look for hardbacks, I think there's some vendors who have them, but they're generally radically priced. I mean, I couldn't afford one. Maybe you can, but no, it's paperback and ebook or nothing right now. And like I said, if you really wanted a hardback, you could find one on, especially on Amazon and the vendors. If you just keep clicking on the accounts there, but no, paperback and ebook, and then pretty soon a film, hopefully. And so that'll be it.
Well, there's one other thing I was wondering. You were talking about how you're researching other types of issues surrounding World War II, as far as like the Germanic people being tortured and killed. Like, have you looked into the anarcho-communist killing of the Mennonites over there in Russia after the Russian Revolution? Because it seems like they went through some similar things.
Yeah, no, I haven't. I'm an expert on this book, but I'm not an expert on the communist revolution, the Bolshevik takeover and occupation, and the slaughter. The slaughter fields that the Bolsheviks put the Ukrainians through, the Holodomor, and the murder of religious sects like the Mennonites. I've heard about this. And let's face it, communism, thank God, is dead. At least I think it is. And anybody who sticks their head up and says they're a communist, probably it's our duty to, let that old game where you knocked Elmo in the head, it's our duty to hit them in the head with something, because it's been the most bloodthirsty political philosophy the world has ever known, communism.
Well, Tom, they're allowed to fly the communist flag in different parades, and people wear communist paraphernalia, and that's not a problem in our current culture, if you can call it that, at different universities. That's politically correct, even though you can go through the historical examples of tens of millions in just in one country alone where the communist touch hold. You could think of Mao. You could think of Stalin, of course, and even before Stalin came to power, what communism did. But yet that's allowed. But if you so much as say anything good about the National Socialists, about the German people, then you need to be, you know, silenced, expelled from the university. You need to be arrested. That's the current state of affairs of the world today. That's what we need to start changing here.
Yeah, we understand, I think, a growing body of individuals that it's a Jewish-occupied world, quite honestly. The powers of control are in Jewish hands right now. And it's no surprise to me that, yes, the communist flag, a flag symbolic of bloodthirstiness and avarice and criminality and vicious depravity, can be flown with pride by certain jackals among us, and but that's the reality of occupation. Yeah, once we are free, once we break off these chains of slavery that we've known for the past 100 years, then I'll tell you what, I'll be magnanimous in victory. I will allow them. I will still allow them to fly any flag they want in any parade they want, but everybody will be able to wave their own flag no matter what. There will be no line drawn that you can or cannot. Unlike these creatures now who run the world, there's only one side, and that's their side.
Well, you know what? This allied force of the United States did such a good job winning that war against those evil Germans that now in the United States, flying an American flag or having an American flag shirt is considered racist. So that just goes to show you that the American people and none of the Allied powers actually really won that war. All of the European people and others lost World War II.
But the tide is turning. We are we're living proof right now that things are turning around. More and more people, I can see it, I can feel it. I've been around a lot longer than you, Kyle. I can see the change. It's very encouraging. I was on a program yesterday, believe it or not, mainstream radio talk show program, and the lady host startled me. She said, oh, I'll fly the American flag, but I'll fly it upside down. She still believes in this country or is still proud of what it once was, but she's so upset now that she wants to show to the world that she's unhappy with the course we're taking right now.
I'd fly an upside-down American flag. I agree with that. Yeah. Awodian, do you have any further comments, or can we go on to the next caller here?
Really, I just want to say I think it's great what you guys are doing, trying to educate people on the reality of National Socialism and everything, because that's largely how, you know, white solidarity and everything has been demonized, you know, so if we can educate people on that, then I think that's going to make a big difference in getting people to reconsider their views on why people sticking together, you know.
You know, the one thing, the only good thing I can see from this unlimited, unbridled illegal immigration to the country of dark-colored peoples is that it is creating us as a minority, but in that shrinking minority, we've become more cohesive. And we suddenly look around and try to see who looks like us, because ultimately that's who we're going to fall back upon. Yes, we've got a lot of people we need to take care of among our own people. But I see great cohesion and solidarity coming about every week. I see this. It's stronger and stronger. So let's look for the good where we can find it. And although I wish we could stop illegal immigration to America, but I think it's gone so far now that we might as well let it continue at this point, because I think we're growing stronger every week that it continues, quite honestly.
Yeah, I agree. Thanks for the call, Woodian.
You're welcome.
And I think this is Jeb in Alabama. Jeb, welcome to the show. Questions or comments? Not having a good time hearing you here, Jeb. Can you maybe speak up or try again?
Can you hear me now?
Somewhat.
Just barely, Jeb.
Jeb, unfortunately, I don't think we're going to be able to take your call tonight just because it's not coming through very well. It's all garbled up. But I thank you for calling in. If you have a computer where you can type the question in the chat, we'll try to answer it.
Yeah, do that, Jeb. I'd like to hear you.
All right. Thanks, Jeb.
I think we've that was weird. What's causing that? It's
I don't know. He's on a cell phone, I think, or maybe it's a landline. It's definitely not a Skype number, so it should be coming through all right.
Mm-hmm.
That's weird. All right, we've got one more person here. This should be Tom Bowie in La Plata, Maryland. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir. With all of the obvious changes being forced upon people right in their face, it seems that suddenly we have true information coming out, even though most people haven't been exposed to it yet. Do you see people or more people looking for that information now, in your view, of the true historic facts, or trying to figure out what's been going on for this 100 years?
Gosh, let me pause to reflect on that a little bit. I think it's part of the natural human condition to be curious about what happened. You have this body of belief that you've been told, or that you've been told you should believe in. And I think there's a great skepticism sweeping the country right now about virtually anything that we're told in the mainstream media. And by that, I mean also academia. I mean books, publications, TV, movies. And I think there's a skepticism and growing cynicism about any history that's becoming a religion, and World War II certainly fits that category. And so when someone comes up with a book, not necessarily my book, there are other books that have come out about talking about various aspects of World War II. They seem to be pretty good sellers, quite honestly. And I can tell you, once my book gets going, it's starting to sell more and more every week, that there is a curiosity. I don't know if it's a thirst so much for history as it's a thirst for truth, or to upset or unsettle or disrupt the course of modern history or the modern events, current events. People have become so disillusioned with this government. They may still love their country, America, but I don't know anybody that loves this government. This government has become a monster. This government spies on us. This government not only spies on us, but it allows Israel to spy on us and collect the data. It's in one war after another. Fought for who? Not for us, I guarantee you. It's fought for Israel. Illegal aliens. We could stop that in one day if we wanted to, this invasion from the south. But we don't want to. Our government really throws up roadblocks for those who want to stop it, who try to stop it. And I can go on and on about the grievances that Americans have for its government. And so I think any form of authority that seems to be at risk or is threatened right now, people will reach for it, including books like mine that are against the standard approach to history. So I don't know if I'm answering your question. Is that close enough, La Plata?
Yes, sir.
Tom, and is that La Plata or La Plata?
Depends on how you wish to pronounce it. locally, it's usually pronounced La Plata.
Uh-huh. I've been there before a couple of times. I've been down to Port Tobacco, where John Wilkes Booth on his escape route. I don't know if you know that story.
Yes,
I
sir.
I wrote a couple of books on the Lincoln assassination also. But that's a beautiful country over there, by the way, Southern Maryland. And I've got to say this, are you a native Marylander?
Yes, sir.
Maryland, it's one of the smaller states, and yet I defy anybody to find any more varied state than Maryland. You can find the most beautiful and mysterious swamps in Maryland, and yet go out to western Maryland and you can freeze to death up in some of the mountains there. And that's a very small state. But anyway, I know I digress, but we've been talking about such grim subjects all night. It's kind of nice to actually talk about beautiful places I've known.
Unfortunately, the area in which I live has become more and more diverse over the years.
Yes, I know. I know where you're at. I know exactly where you're at.
Tom, do you take a fairly positive, and I'm talking to Tom Goodrich here, do you take a fairly positive view on American history and what the white Europeans here were able to accomplish? Or do you take the view that some people in the alternative media do, that it was all a scam from the beginning, and it was a criminal this and that, it was a conspiracy to screw people? And what's your general take on what was done here in America historically?
Do you mean, was there ever a time when leaders really cared?
Yes, pretty much. Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah. You know, I really do, and I believe there was a time that right after Washington's inauguration when they really did believe in this experiment. I'm sure they did. The amount of man hours they put in on the Constitution and hammering out the Bill of Rights and the Articles of Confederation. And then I think the Civil War and the growing schism between the sections over slavery, and I think that's where pardon the pun, but that's where everything went south. Deanna Spingola, intrepid, wonderful person with her own radio program. And Tom, have you ever heard of Deanna Spingola's program?
No, sir, I haven't.
You might try that. I think she's still on in the daytime, but also on the weekend. But she talks a lot about America began turning away from its people, the government, that is, during the American Civil War. And I can't disagree with her. I'd never thought much about it, quite honestly, even though I had read or written books on the American Civil War. But yeah, you've got to believe that Lincoln did usurp the Constitution. Lincoln did imprison people without a writ of habeas corpus. Lincoln was one of the first, he was the only president I know of, that actually did allow torture to take place at the State Department. There's many terrible things. Lincoln prosecuted a war against the American people themselves, the Southerners. And you know, what's that old saying about, once the government grants itself a privilege, it never gives it back. Something like that. Or once they take away the freedom, you'll never get it back. And I think probably that's where we started going off on this road where we now find ourselves at the cliff's edge. Probably was the American Civil War. And then World War I, of course, which we had no business getting into. And I think everything else, as they say, is history. Kyle, I don't know if I answered your question, but I can't talk at length and expertly about it. These are just my thoughts, shooting from the hip.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate them. Tom Bowie, any thoughts of yours or any other questions?
I kind of see with all of the trouble they're attempting to stir up now, as if they're trying to, since the last two wars worked out so well for them, it looks like they're trying to start another massive war in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think it might backfire, but yeah, go ahead, please.
Do you see our people actually waking up to that fact as well? That this is more propaganda for another atrocity that benefits no one?
You know, Tom, the American Revolution, I've read some facts and figures about that. And surprisingly, only I think 6% of the American population was actively engaged in that war. That is the war against the King of England. And of the rest of the percent of population, I think it was only like another 6 or 7% that indirectly supported the revolution. So we've got roughly 13% of the American population that are doing anything to help this the revolution and this war against England to become a free people. And, you know, I don't think the percentage has changed at all since then. I think we still have roughly 87% of the American people that are out in the pasture, so to speak, grazing, eating the grass, raising their head every once in a while when a car goes by. But other than that, they don't have a clue and they don't give a damn. On the other hand, there are people like us three right now talking, listening on the radio, who do care. We're the 6% or the other 7%. We're part of that 13%. I think we've always had those people. I think we always will have those people. So to answer your question, are the people aroused or aware of what's going on? And I agree with what you're saying, by the way. I would say yes, the same 13% that were aroused and aware in the American Revolution, we're still here. But the others, no. They'll continue to shop at Walmart, watch the World Series. But as far as the war, as long as it's not bothering them, who cares? And that's my opinion. It's a negative opinion, of course. We need, well, it's never happened before for me to wish that 50% of the people would at least come out in favor against the war. I think that's pie in the sky stuff. And so it probably will never happen, but then it never has happened. And it really doesn't take the other 87%. It just takes us, the 6 and 7 and 13%, to be the hardcore anti or pro or whatever it is we're working for or against, to fight like hell, to make sure, you know, you can do a lot of things. You don't have to get on a radio and talk. You can, whenever you see somebody throwing up smoke about how great it would be to go to war with Russia and what a devil and Hitler, Putin is, refute that. Contradict that person. Don't let them get away with it. When they raise their head, hit them. I'm speaking, of course, in figurative terms. But whenever someone is raising a voice for what we don't believe in, it's our duty to put them down, to shut them up, or at least offer an argument against them. So for too long, we have just turned the other cheek. Too many of us have adhered to that, the Christian approach to life, basically turn the other cheek, forgive and forget. That stuff's got us exactly where we're at right now. You've got to abandon so much of that baggage and basically, well, take the gloves off. Anyway, I'm going on. Like I said, I'm shooting from the hip on this and out of my element. But then again, that's just my opinion.
Any further thoughts, Tom?
Oh, I've listened to, from just the talk I've heard, that's a book that'll have to be read a couple of times. There was so much information that just came out on the radio, it's hard to imagine how much will be in the book.
Yeah, it's, let me say this. What I say on the radio is one thing. I tend to shoot from the hip. I have my own opinion. I have my own bias. I'm prejudiced in many ways. I know what I like and what I don't like. However, as a historian, and I've been a historian for 30 years, I've written about a dozen books. I've always prided myself on accuracy. I've always attempted to remain as unbiased as I possibly can when I'm writing a history book. My theory of writing a book is this is no place to parade your prejudices. In other words, set the banquet table with all the food, all the research food that you can put on the table, and then allow the reader to come and take what they want from the table. Don't force feed anybody. I'm not going to beat anybody over the head. I try to tell the book as honestly and objectively as I possibly can. It's in the words of the people themselves. It's not really me talking. I'm holding them together with my rather brief narrative, as Kyle knows. But mostly this is the people's story of what it looked like to lose the world's worst war. And if I can allow them to tell their story, that's all that needs to be done. I don't need to put in any bias or any prejudice in this book. They do a well enough job telling it themselves.
Well, Tom, I hope you get the book. Something that I really need to read. I'm glad I did, and I hope other people do as well.
Yes, thank you, sir. Have a good evening, gentlemen.
You too, Tom.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Tom Goodrich, let's start to wrap things up here. But before we do, I had one question about your being a vegetarian, as I myself do not eat meat. When did you actually decide to stop eating meat, and what was the reason for that? I don't usually evangelize about diet whatsoever on the show, but I am interested because, of course, Adolf Hitler is widely said to have been a vegetarian, though this might not have been entirely accurate. What was it about this lifestyle, this dietary choice that brought you there to that position?
It's probably genetic, quite honestly. Just like history, I think I have a history gene, a predilection to writing history. I think I have a predilection to be a vegetarian. I think I've always loved animals, all animals. No, I'm not so stupid as I'd walk up to a wolf or a tiger and love them, hug them, squeeze them, but I have respect for them. And probably when I would flinch as a child and my dad would skin catfish after he'd caught him, or a squirrel when he'd shot one, or when I saw a hog chained by his rear legs lifted up and his throat cut when I was a kid. Things like that stuck with me, until finally Easter, 1981. I was in Greece, living in Greece, down around Kalamata, where the olives are, in Peloponnese. And Easter in Greece, at least down in this area among the peasants, was a festival, a festive time. They take off 2 weeks from work and enjoy life and fun and feasting. And part of the feast is every family seems to buy or raise a baby lamb or a kid goat for the feast. And it seems to be a family endeavor for all of them to get together and kill this animal, and skin it, and gut it, and broil it, and eat it. And I saw so much of this going on, and the cries of these animals as they were having their throats cut. I still hear it to this day. And I had been working toward vegetarianism prior to that. I had really cut back because I just knew it wasn't right. But from that time, I never ate another piece of meat knowingly. Now, I have by accident. And I was raised on meat. I was raised on hamburger and pork chops and you name it, chicken, turkey. So it's not like, I would spit meat out once I had it. For instance, I might buy a can of beans and inadvertently eat some pork that was in it. But no, after that day, I never willingly, knowingly ate a piece of meat, and I've never regretted it. Now, that said, a lot of people should be vegetarians, even if they don't give a damn about the animals. They should care about themselves. I also worked on farms as a kid. I grew up in Kansas, Missouri, as a kid, and I worked on farms. I saw what happened to the animals, how they were treated, the inoculations, the things that people stick in animals to make them put on weight and be beefier and be bulkier. If people knew how animals were treated and how they were killed, we'd have a lot more vegetarians in the world. But what's your story, Kyle?
Well, it's an interesting one that's somewhat similar to yours. I'm not going to go too in-depth with it, but I remember as a child being averse to meat when I knew it was meat. I would sometimes eat something that didn't whatsoever resemble flesh, like chopped up hot dog or meatballs or tuna fish, and I would like it until I was told what it was. It took me a long time to even really want to eat anything, like even eggs, which I still do eat to this day just because I don't eat any of the other animal products. I sometimes will eat eggs. I enjoy them, but I didn't eat them for many, many years because I didn't feel attracted to them. And meat in general, especially pork products. It took me many, many years to even try ham. And probably the fact that the flesh looks so similar to our own is what turned me off from eating pig. But I also just love animals. And it was in my mid-20s that I finally decided just to give it up and didn't want to really ever go back after that. Now, I did eat deer since becoming a vegetarian. And you know what? If people want to eat meat, I think that if you kill it yourself and you're part of that process, then you really deserve the right, more of a right than those who just buy it all packaged and processed straight from a farm where that animal, that sentient creature, never even saw a ray of sunlight. The way that animals are treated in the United States in particular, but in most of the world, is very appalling to me. And I find that to be a great injustice. And when we treat these sentient creatures in this way, it's not a big leap to think that we would also treat our own kin in this way, as well as is shown throughout Hellstorm. So I do think that these things are somewhat related.
Mm-hmm. You're a philosophical vegetarian, then. I'm glad to know it. I am too. Those people who are not, those people who are vegetarian just for health reasons, bless them too. At least they care about themselves enough that they won't. You know, like I said, I'm from the West. I had a real close view of the meat industry. It's not a pretty picture. I'm going to tell you, the West is full, especially in isolated areas of Kansas and Oklahoma and Texas and Colorado, off the interstates, away from public view, that you can see where these feedlots are at. These feedlots are generally located on a barren hillside above a wash or a creek or a small river. And animals are taken in and left there for at least 2 weeks. I think they've been there for as many as 2 months. But a rancher will take his cows in to the feedlot to have them bulk up before they go to market, before they're actually weighed and paid. And it's a hideous thing indeed. It looks like some of the German concentration camps where Eisenhower kept those men. There's not a blade of grass, not a stick growing. It's nothing but a mud pit where they stand. They stand on their own feces, they stand in their own urine, and they eat when the tractor comes out and gives them the grain in the bin. But other than that, there's nothing for them to do except stand there in the sun, in the rain, day after day, feeding, bulking up, standing in their urine and excrement, and that's their existence before they go to the slaughterhouse. And of course, when they go to the slaughterhouse, then the panic hits, and I've been by many slaughterhouses driving by, and the sounds, if we had a soundtrack for Hellstorm, this would probably be it, the metal clanking, the sounds of screams, the animals, the white eyes, there's a palpable sense of fear, smell of fear as you go by a slaughterhouse, as these animals are waiting. They know very well what's going on. Don't forget, they've got better sense of smell than we do. They can smell the blood. They can smell the fear. So that's how an animal spends his last months on Earth before you eat him, before he is packaged in a plastic container at Burger King and you eat him. That's not a healthy way to eat. I'm going to tell you that.
Well, Tom, this is obviously going to upset some of our listeners who defend
that's okay.
Meeting completely, and that's fine.
That's okay.
I'm fine with that. But I also just wanted to bring up the point that the Jewish supremacists consider us goyim, cattle. Now, we should also consider whether or not we ourselves consider other sentient creatures to be our goyim.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a direct connection between the way we are treated and the way that we also treat others upon this planet. It's just a cycle of abuse from birth and enslavement as well. This is the world we live in. Enslavement, abuse, and blood rituals.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a saying, and I can't think of it, but it's to understand a man's heart. Watch how he treats those around him that are powerless. In other words, kids and animals. Then you know the true heart of a person. And anybody who treats the powerless, the kids, the women, the people that, you know, that's a big person to me. And by the way, no, Kyle, I don't think anybody listening to this program could be terribly upset with what you said. Well, let's face it, we both have eaten meat. I was a meat eater. We'd be hypocrites to jump on people now who do eat meat. I wish they didn't. They'd be healthier, and so would the animals, I guarantee you. And they'd be a stronger person, and I believe even a happier person as a result. This is poison they're putting in their system. The system we live in right now doesn't give a rat whether you're being poisoned or not, and you are being poisoned, I'm going to tell you. Nevertheless, that's what they chose to do, and they've got their own mind and own willpower and own strengths. Yeah, but I see what you're saying, and I agree. Shouldn't we treat virtually every creature on Earth the way we would want to be treated?
Ideally, unless they're trying to kill us, unless they're a predator and mm-hmm. they're trying to make us their prey.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, Tom, let's go back and touch upon any other thing that we talked about tonight, or any concluding remarks that you'd like to make, or any words about the documentary that you'd like to give off to people. And one more time, could you tell people how they can get that book signed by you, and also anything else you'd like to promote?
I think what I'd like to say so far, now, honestly, we're pretty early in this film. And by the way, Kyle Hunt is doing 95% of the work. Tom Goodrich wrote a book, but Kyle Hunt's doing the movie. And it's based upon the book. That's true. But Kyle is doing the work. But still, I can say this. I am extremely impressed by your vision for this film, and even more so, more impressed. I'm very impressed by the logistics involved that you seem to understand. This is going to be a very well done film. I'm convinced. The people you're talking about, the voices, the script, the clips, the movie or the music. This is going to be, I almost said fun. It's not going to be that. It's not going to be fun at all, but it's going to be a monument to what we're talking about tonight, a monument to these voiceless victims that suffered through the world's worst war. The book, my book, is available at Amazon.com, paperback and ebook, the world's largest bookstore, or you can get it from me for $20. That's as cheap as you'll get it anywhere. $20, that's postage included if you live in the United States. Anybody listening tonight who is in Canada or beyond the United States, get a hold of me first because the postage is really radical expensive. But drop $20 into my PayPal account. That's M as in Michael, T as in Thomas, Goodrich, Michael Thomas, Goodrich, MT Goodrich at AOL.com. And I'll shoot a book to you the next morning.
Tom, how about this? Mm-hmm. One kind of final question from me, and you can wrap up however you'd like. But I tend to think that the dead are actually smiling upon our endeavors, and that what we're doing is in some way helping them. Now you're something of an atheist. I have gathered. Mm-hmm. I think you might have said this on past programs. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you necessarily title yourself an atheist, but I tend to think that there's a little bit more to this world than meets the eye. This is obvious. We only see a very small fraction of this. What this world actually is, the visible spectrum. We're only able to reach out with just a few senses. Do you think that what we're doing does actually have some kind of larger spiritual impact, or that is in some way not just a monument to the dead, but a way of helping them?
Well, you know, Kyle, you're right, though. I am an atheist. Let's put it this way. I'm not a proud atheist. I'm not a happy atheist. I wish I was wrong. I think I'm right, but I wish I was wrong. I hope you're right. I hope some of these tormented souls whose last moments of existence were just sheer torture and horror, I hope they are. I hope they're saying or giving us strength or helping us along. I don't believe that personally, but you might be right. I think the best I could say is this book, this film, what we've been talking about, if we do nothing else, maybe we can, by a degree, prevent anything else like this happening in the future. Maybe from what we're doing right now, we can save others. I don't care who they are. We can save other folks from a fate similar to that experienced by Germany. I think that's worthy enough to fight for. Now, if you're right, Kyle, maybe there's a place for me also. I don't know if I'm going up or down in this case, but it would be joyous, glorious to be greeted by people who say thank you. You didn't have to do it, but you did it. I would love that. And, well, maybe you will, Kyle. I don't know. Maybe I won't.
Tom, I think that your deeds in this world will at least echo into eternity, and that future generations will be impacted by them. So you will live on in one way or another, whether or not it's, in line with any kind of other religious doctrine is of no concern to me. Tom, I really appreciate you being on the show tonight. This is difficult material, and you are an invaluable resource to us all because you've been willing to look into it and shed light upon this very dark period of history. And your intentions are very honorable in terms of what you are seeking to achieve with this. And I'm very glad that you've done the work that you have, and I'm very glad to be working with you to help bring this out to even more people. So thank you once again.
Hey, Kyle, again, thanks for having me on, and thanks for your incredible work, and thanks for your vision, and I'll probably talk to you tomorrow, won't I?
All right, yes, I think so.
Thanks a lot, Kyle.
All right, take care. Good
Bye-bye.
Night. And thanks out there to all of you listening to this program. Really do appreciate all of your support, everybody who has contributed, everybody who has helped in some way, shape, or form. It really does all add up, and I really appreciate you guys all being part of RenegadeBroadcasting.com. Please check out all the other great hosts, and I'm going to go out with a little bit more music tonight, and you can expect me back again next week.
as the windshield melts and my tears evaporate. Leaving only charcoal to defend. Finally, I understand the feelings of the few. Ashes and diamonds, foe and friend. We were all equal in the end. Thank you.